In the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States, the Cold War seemed to heat up one last time. Anti-Soviet rhetoric became something of a hallmark of the Reagan administration. It was Reagan, after all, who called the Soviet Union, quote, the evil empire. And who could forget Reagan's most often quoted challenge to the Soviet leadership in Berlin?
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
But aside from these more grandiose moments of anti-communist rhetoric, Reagan also loved peppering his speeches with Soviet humor. He loved telling jokes that he claimed were told on the street by average Soviet citizens. Here's the Gipper himself with a few great examples of this.
One of the more recent ones that I heard was about the man walking along the street at night, Moscow. Soviet soldier called to him to halt. He started to run. The soldier shot him. And another man said, why did you do that? Well, he said, curfew. Well, he said, it isn't curfew yet. He said, I know. He's a friend of mine. I know where he lives. He couldn't have made it. I heard one about a fellow who went to the KGB to report that he lost his parrot. The KGB asked him why he was bothering them. Why didn't he just report it to the local police? Well, he answered, I just want you to know that I don't agree with a thing my parrot has to say.
Now, being the skeptic that I am, I originally thought that these jokes had to have been made up by Americans. They seemed just a little too perfect for a Ronald Reagan speech. But it seems like Reagan actually directed the CIA to collect cynical jokes from the Soviet Union so he could use them. Now, it's perhaps easy to see how cynical jokes proliferated near the end of the Soviet era. But what about under Stalin? Was humor, and specifically political humor, even possible during one of the most repressive eras in Soviet history? This question is what motivated the writing of John Waterlow's fascinating new book, It's Only a Joke, Comrade: Humor, Trust, and Everyday Life Under Stalin. In this book, John explores the weird, absurd, and often hilarious world of humor under Stalin. In the course of his study, he examines what types of jokes people were telling about the regime and its leaders, and tries to determine what these jokes can tell us about Soviet society. Along the way, he ends up confronting a number of myths about the cult of Stalin, the so-called atomization of Soviet society, and the complicated ways in which people cope with oppression. But the question is there anything funny about Stalinism? Well, let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 76, How Does John Waterlow Make Sense of Stalin Jokes? Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we have a very special interview with John Waterlow, author of It's Only a Joke, Comrade. But before we get to that, I want to take a moment to recognize an indispensable member of the Our Fake History team. And this is our artist in residence, Frank Fiorentino. Those of you who've been following the show for a long time know how essential Frank is to our whole aesthetic. Most of the podcast apps out there will actually show Frank's art as the episode art every single week for this show. However, some of the apps don't do this, so there's a chance that maybe you haven't seen Frank's art. If you haven't, then you should really go to ourfakehistory.com and go through our archives and look at all the amazing art that he's made for every single episode of this show. It's always so impressive. Frank has a very distinctive comic book inspired style of art that I absolutely love. He either creates a really interesting portrait each week, or he comes up with some fascinating concept that blows me away. It's great. I wouldn't want to do this podcast without him. Now, I wanted to let you all know that Frank is currently available to do commissions. That means if you reach out to him, he will create a beautiful piece of art just for you. If you're a fan of comic books, this is an especially great opportunity. If you've ever wanted a really great Daredevil or Green Lantern or Wolverine, then Frank is your guy. But he's really capable of anything. He just did an amazing series of Star Trek characters for October. So if you think you'd be interested in getting a Frank Fiorentino original commissioned, you should reach out to him on Twitter at Frank Fio, that's FrankFio, or on Instagram at Fiorentino Frank, that's FiorentinoFrank. He's the best. I know that there have been other OFH fans out there who've had Frank art created in the past, and all of them have been very satisfied. So please check it out. All right. So there's this joke, and it goes like this. Stalin was out swimming, but he began to drown. A worker from a collective farm who was passing by jumped in to save him. Stalin started to ask the worker what he would like as his reward. When the worker realized who he'd just saved, he said, "Nothing, just please don't tell anyone that I saved you." Just like all Soviet jokes, that little zinger is loaded with meaning. In It's Only a Joke, Comrade, Oxford PhD John Waterlow uses jokes like these as a way of examining things about Soviet society that are often hard to describe accurately. For instance, it can be hard to know what the average Russian actually thought of Stalin. Waterlow's study shows us that there are clues hidden in jokes that can help us understand how people made sense of a society where it was often dangerous to speak out. John is a PhD who received his doctorate from the University of Oxford and went on to hold a British Academy postdoctoral fellowship at St. Anthony's College. He's also been a visiting postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto and studied at the universities of Edinburgh, St. Andrews, and the Harrison State Pedagogical University in St. Petersburg, Russia. John was also co-director of Oxford's War Crimes Research Network. Now, if you have never read a book that was developed out of a PhD thesis, this is actually a great one to start with. Sometimes writing that's meant for an academic audience can be a little impenetrable for those that aren't used to it. But John's book is actually quite accessible. The fact that the whole study is anchored by jokes really makes it a lot of fun to read. Now, before we get into the interview, I do need to say a few words about the sound quality. Now, I haven't mentioned this on the show, but I've recently moved house. So that means that my entire recording setup has just changed. This interview just happened to be one of the first things that I recorded in my new space. And sure enough, my trusty podcasting microphone failed me. Luckily, the built-in microphone in my laptop got my side of the interview. The result is that John sounds beautiful, crisp, and clear, and I sound like I'm at the bottom of a well. So I apologize in advance for that. I'm usually pretty particular about the sound quality on the show, so honestly, this was quite frustrating. Luckily, my guest was incredibly gracious, and the sound on his side of the conversation was gorgeous. So despite that technical snafu, we still had a really interesting conversation, and I hope that you enjoy it. One other thing. Our conversation veers from being very academic to being very dirty. To talk about the jokes in this book, we needed to talk about some explicitly sexual stuff. As a result, we use some language on this podcast that I don't usually use on the show. So if you're listening with younger people, then discretion is advised. There's some pretty coarse language coming your way. Now, John and I are also happy to announce that we're doing a special giveaway of his book. So here's how it works. You need to email me your best original Stalin joke. The best joke about Stalin will get read on the next episode of Our Fake History, and you will be mailed a free copy of It's Only a Joke, Comrade. So to try your hand at the contest, you need to live in either North America or Europe. Sorry, Aussies and Kiwis, you're just a little too far away. We apologize. But if you live in North America or Europe, send your joke and your mailing address to ourfakehistory@gmail.com. I can't wait to see what you guys come up with. Okay, without further ado, here is my conversation with John Waterlow. John, hello. Welcome to Our Fake History. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, okay. First, I have to tell you that I really, really enjoyed reading It's Only a Joke, Comrade. Actually, for the listeners out there, reading this book is what inspired this entire Stalin series. Stalin was one of those figures that I thought, if I'm ever going to get to doing like a big boy like Hitler, maybe I could kind of get my feet wet with someone like Stalin, who has just as much mythology, has just the same sort of a terrible reputation, but is not quite the same political lightning rod that Hitler is in our current climate anyway. So what I loved about your book, though, kind of emboldened me to do it, is that it just reminded me, you know, how much this figure had constructed an elaborate mythology. And what was so great about your book was how humor can be used to sort of puncture a mythology or complicate a mythology or mess with how people sort of puff themselves up. And I really love that. So thank you to start.
Well, thank you. I was kind of amazed when it prompted a series to come out, which I've been really enjoying listening to as well. So it's already a treat to have listened to that, let alone get a chance to talk with you.
Well, thanks a lot, man. And mutual admiration society going here. But from the hop, I have to ask, why humor? Why did you choose to focus on Soviet humor as a way into understanding Soviet society? Why did you go there?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me that question, usually in very skeptical voices. I think there's a tendency to think that if we're going to talk about a subject or a time period which is generally known to have been very hard or terrible or horrifying, that somehow to talk about humor is kind of tasteless, as though it's inappropriate or is making light of the situation. Mm. But that's... humor is universal, and humor definitely didn't disappear in these conditions. If anything, it became so much more important as a coping mechanism, yeah, as ways people could try and make sense of their lives. And I knew that when I started out, it started as a PhD project, I really wanted to try and understand better how ordinary, politically non-important people managed to make sense of a life that seemed to be lived amidst endless contradictions, because on the one hand, they had this glorious narrative of what was being promised from the regime and what they were told was happening right now. And then they had the daily realities of poverty, of immense fear at different times, the fear of denunciation, mass arrests, purges. And I thought, well, how could people make sense of this? And most of the books that I had read that fascinated me most about popular opinion tended to give voice to these people, but had a tendency to just put them into two different categories of these are people who believed in the regime and these are people who didn't. So they were pro or contra the regime.
Right.
And that didn't seem very satisfying, because I don't think anywhere in the world can you neatly divide a population along those lines. And
right,
then
yeah,
in these books, suddenly they might bring up a joke or two, and they'd used it just as a kind of, oh, look, here's something entertaining before we get back to the stories of brainwashing or terror. Mm. But after I read some of these, I was like, wait a second, that doesn't really fit with anything. These jokes don't sound like people who are committed resistors who loathe everything about the regime. And it doesn't sound, therefore, like they're also brainwashed and love Big Brother. Like, what's going on here? Because there was a foreign correspondent called William Chamberlain who lived a long time in the Soviet Union. And I can't remember the quote exactly, but he said it seemed as though the Soviet Union could be simultaneously thought of as a terror, menace, and a laughing stock, something like that, to the outside world. And I thought, well, surely it had to seem like that to the people on the inside too. It was all these contradictory things. But they were under a lot more pressure to try and make some sense of it, because nobody likes to go through life feeling as though it doesn't make some kind of sense and doesn't mean something. So I thought, okay, let's go and see if I can find more jokes and try and tie them to specific situations and understand how and why and to whom people could share them.
What I loved about your study is that the people who are on the ground don't seem to fit well into any particular category. And the way that you described that is you used this really interesting metaphor, and I really wanted to discuss it. You talk about cross-hatching, which is a metaphor for how people make sense of, I guess, contradictory or different ideas about the same topic. Could you explain what you meant by the metaphor of cross-hatching?
Yeah, so it came up in a novel that I was reading. It was sort of a science fiction style novel. So it used what I've used as a metaphor. It used as though it was a fact, a reality. And in that story, there were two cities that were culturally and linguistically and politically separate, but they existed essentially in the same geographical location. So there's two realities sitting there, but the people of each city were not allowed to officially see or interact with the other city. So they had to navigate around unseeing the stuff that wasn't meant to be there. And that struck me immediately as being like the Soviet Union. You're meant to go through life pretending as though the official narrative of how things are meant to be does exist. And you're meant to unsee all of the things that contradicts it. However, in that story, there were the cross-hatched areas, which is where the two things overlap, and it's not very clear to which city or which world they really belong. And it's a really interesting novel called The City in the City by China Mieville, if anyone wants to investigate it. But to try and tease this out a bit, it's the cross-hatching is a drawing technique. And that means you take one set of hatching, which means a lot of parallel lines going in one direction. You take another set of parallel lines going in another direction, and together they can create this incredible three-dimensionality. It's kind of the holy grail of for people who work with a pencil. And if it, in everyday, to give it a sort of everyday reality, if we imagine that the things, the expectations of culture or our bosses or our political leaders are like the vertical lines of hatching coming down and influencing us, and then we have our own desires, our own realities and priorities, they're like the horizontal lines, they have to meet and mix. It's not that they cancel each other out. So if I go to work and my boss demands I act a certain way, I have to take that into account. But I also want to do things the way I want to do them. And we all find ways in life to kind of find the balance where we can still do what we want to an extent, but also have to accept there are rules, restrictions, and regulations being placed on us. And in that's where life happens, in the middle, where those things happen, because we never get to do entirely 100% what we want. And generally, for most of us, we're not going to allow it to be the case that we always have to do or say or think or believe what we're told that we have to do. So it's the middle zone where I think life happens. And in a lot of the historiography surrounding this period, people have begun to acknowledge it, but they call it this gray zone between affirmation and dissent. And I said, it doesn't seem very gray. It certainly seems complicated. It certainly isn't just I believe or I don't believe, but what's happening in that zone? And in cross-hatching is, as I said, it's this drawing technique. And in the middle of that technique is where things come to life. That's where, by mixing these influences, we actually see shapes emerge, patterns and reality and meaning is formed where those two influences are interacting with each other.
Yeah, no, I loved that idea. And I loved when you said in your introduction about how, you know, people speak of a gray area, but you're like, in what way is it gray? I'm like, oh, that's a good question. I love that idea of it's not just or our political ideas versus our experienced reality isn't just some smush. There's that moment where you can kind of focus on one thing. And that's why I love that metaphor. Like, you can focus on one line in the crosshatch at one point, and then another line in the crosshatch at another point, and then sometimes focus on them together. And I know we're getting into the weeds on this particular metaphor. I thought it was a great way to explain the complexity of how people experience a political reality.
Yeah, maybe a simpler way to put it. I should practice trying to communicate it, because I feel like in the book it becomes clear through all the examples that come out, but it's hard to sum up. But one other way I put it was, the regime hands you a map of how the world is meant to be, and you look at the map and you're like, okay, that's meant to be there. I walk out of my house, things aren't quite matching up. Okay, I know I need to use this map to some extent, but I'm also going to start adding on all the things that I actually experience. So you end up with two maps on one page, which together become the reality that you experience.
I thought about that for quite a while. And so another great sort of great thing about this book, and what makes it, I think, so readable, and one thing I'll say to anyone listening out there, if you've never read a PhD style book, this is a good one to kind of get your feet wet with, because it's got all the sort of high level thinking that you'd expect from some serious academia. However, it's peppered with jokes. It's filled with jokes that makes it just so readable and actually a pretty brisk read. And one thing that struck me off the top about the jokes is that most of them are just completely absurd. They're so weird. They're so out there. Sometimes the political point is even hard to discern in the joke. Right at the top of your book, you talk about how sometimes it could be as simple as one person sort of nudging another and saying, hey, look at that statue. If you look from this angle, that pointing finger kind of looks like his dick. I thought that was great. It was just like, maybe there's just this angle we've got to take on the regime to see the absurdity of it. Why do you think so many of the jokes were so wacky, I guess, or absurd.
Yeah, I had to think about that because, you know, I'm finding these things in the archives and going, what is this supposed to mean? Like some of them have, are just funny rhymes put together in which Stalin and some of the other leaders are riding around like on a donkey with a fish in one pocket and an onion in his mouth. And I'm like, what does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
And what I came up with is that a lot of the use of absurdity is people, ordinary people, drawing the high and mighty and the untouchable, the people who have power over their lives, and putting them into a story context in which they're made to look completely absurd and where the storyteller, the joke teller, can feel superior to them. Mm-hmm. And it's as though if we wanted to take some of our modern day leaders and throw them in a crazy cartoon, suddenly they look daft and ridiculous and we get to take a step back and go, huh, look at these fools. And that creates a reassuring sense of your own ability to see through things, of a way in which to assert your superiority, which was a key part of humor in many cases. And to just kind of take the edge and the teeth out of what was a very harsh reality for them. Because when you can laugh at something, it becomes much less intimidating and frightening. And that's one of the core ways that gallows humor works, laughing mm-hmm. about terrifying, unchangeable circumstances. Yeah. Because when you put something that is unchangeable and outside of your power to control, as if you had been sentenced to death and you're on your way to face it, if you can make a joke about it, then you put it into this genre, this situation where things aren't meant to make sense. And we know that we can laugh at them, and that provides an emotional release. And it allows us to give ourselves, it doesn't explain circumstances, but it explains them away, even for just a moment, and releases some emotional tension.
Right. Yeah, well, while you were doing your research, and I don't know if you have these at hand, but like, were there particular jokes that just completely confused you, that stopped you in your tracks? Like what other than like, you know, a fish in his pocket and an onion in his mouth? Are there any other jokes that kind of pop to mind of a that absurdist style?
Ah, it's a good question, because now that I've spent so many years getting used to them, they all seem like they make a clear kind of sense to me. Mm. Were there other ones that popped out for you that really took some explaining, where I had to break it down?
Well, actually, some of the stuff that stuck out for me was the dirty jokes. There are so many jokes about poop and piss and then just like dirty sex, homosexuality, not to say homosexuality is dirty, but just like really intense sexual jokes. Some of them were quite kind of cute. Like I just loved the, like we can change the T in Stalin to an R and make Stalin Srollin. So he's no longer the man of steel, but the man of shit.
It's so simple and so effective.
but I guess, I mean, one that I found kind of perplexing and odd and needed a bit of unpacking was a very dirty sentence about Stalin and Kalinin. And I'll quote from your book here. So it goes like this. Kalinin and Stalin were having a business meeting, but soon began to make jokes and fool about. They wanted some women, and they started to tease one another. Kalinin said, "First, I screw you. Otherwise, you might cheat." Stalin readily agreed and let himself be buggered by Kalinin. When the old man, Kalinin, grew tired, he asked for a break. Kalinin dressed and went into his study. There, he wrote a decree which made sodomy punishable by 8 years in prison. He presented it to Stalin and said, "Well, you want 8 years of prison, come and get it." So what is going on there?
This was I couldn't believe what I was reading in the archive, and not just because it was in really bad handwriting in somebody's criminal file because they were arrested for telling this joke.
Right. So
there's a lot of things going on. One of them, I mean, the whole thing is clearly fabricated and is it's made to be crude and lewd, and it works on a number of levels. And one is the simple homophobia, which was the norm then, and frankly is still the norm now in Russia. Mm-hmm. So the idea that both of the leaders would be up for having sex with each other is already, look at these moral degenerates. Let's laugh at them and put them beneath us.
Right.
Then there's the power dynamic that Stalin agrees to be the receiver in this situation, which we still know in a lot of in prison cultures around the world where a lot of homosexual sex happens. If you're the one, like the active so-called role, then you're fine. That doesn't make you gay. You're just getting your rocks off and that's fine.
But when we discussed ancient history, when I was just talking about the Emperor Hadrian, and the dynamic comes up in that that context as well.
Yeah, I remember that episode actually. And so to be the receiver, that's suggests that you are really low and certainly lower than the joke teller. Mm-hmm. So Kalinin, who's technically the head of the government, even though these, you know, Stalin is ultimately the boss, but Kalinin has the power to, it's like, okay, we've done that. I got what I wanted. Now I'm just going to go next door. Oh, I've made a law. So now you can't role reverse this situation. So it's as though we, the people, the audience of the joke, are meant to identify with Kalinin. And be like, yeah, look, you just totally used and degraded and then made a fool of, victimized Stalin. And so you get to celebrate that, pulling him down off such a high pedestal and then putting him way, way, way below you. And, you know, as we generally know, adding in the pornographic or generally X-rated rude material makes it all the funnier because it's so incongruous with the normal way that someone like Stalin will be talked about.
Right. Yeah, and then, but then there's even ones where I'm like, I don't even really understand what's going on. Again, this is like the absurdist realm of sexuality, and it's just a few pages later from that joke we just read, but Kalinin received a rejuvenation treatment. His genitals were replaced with a dog's, and once he left the hospital, from then on, he did everything doggy style. Is that in the same way? Is that just like, I'm just humiliating a leader? Or, I mean, I don't even know what political point you're making other than I'm going to bring low a powerful person.
I mean, I think bringing a powerful person low is a political point. It's not like about a particular policy, but it's definitely about power. And imagining our leaders in the bedroom or doing things that sound absurd is a kind of power move, but it's an admission of weakness too, is my thinking, that if the only thing we can really do and imagine to assert dominance over people who have the real power in the situation is to use this base imagery of sex or feces or all these sorts of things, it kind of implies that we don't have much that we can really use in our toolkit against them. It has to be right down to bodily functions to be able to assert that.
Mm-hmm.
This with Kalinin, it's not as degrading in this case as the one that we just heard about Stalin. And it seemed from what I found that Stalin received the most vicious and degrading examples in the jokes. For this one, it kind of riffs on a weird contemporary trend where there was biological research being done to see if you could transplant the genitals of different animals onto other creatures and see what would happen. And in Mikhail Bulgakov's book, he's best known for writing The Master and Margarita, which was this satire published secretly, which took the piss out of a lot of the Stalinist system. But he wrote an earlier book called The Heart of a Dog, which I think he wrote in the 20s, if I'm right. And that also involved this transplantation, but in reverse, that they take a man's testicles, put them on a dog, and suddenly he becomes a very devout and intense communist.
Right.
I can't claim it makes sense.
Yeah. you brought something up before that I wanted to explore in greater depth, and that has to do with Stalin's roles in these jokes. So you said that, you know, the most vicious and nasty stuff in these jokes was reserved for Stalin. So first, I wondered if you had any examples of that, and two, why you think that's the case.
Yeah, in a way, it's surprising in a way, because the cult of Stalin is such a mainstay in our understanding of the period, mm-hmm. that there's been this prolonged idea you can find in any school textbook to this day that, oh, why was there no popular resistance to this regime despite the gulags, despite the repressions? And one of the key things that's brought up is Stalin created this cult of personality that seemed to raise him above politics and make him essentially a demigod, if not a full-blown deity. Mm-hmm. And so he was seen to sit benignly above everything, and people could try and tell themselves that, okay, there's a lot of problems here, but Stalin is still good, and I believe in him. So yeah. They come, like George Orwell would say, come ultimately to love Big Brother.
Yes.
And yet what I found was that when people were looking for a target, someone to joke about, they would keep on endlessly picking him. So if terrible things happened in their lives, if they're facing starvation, if they've just heard that the number of hours they have to work a day or a week has been vastly increased, they repeat slogans that they hear all the time, which is to thank Stalin for everything. So thank you, Comrade Stalin, that we're not going to have any food for a long time. Like, they invert it from thanking him for providing good things to blaming him for everything.
Right.
And then there's the sexual aspects, some more. They make jokes about, they mock him, but they mock his key policy of collectivization of agriculture. Mm. So everyone hated the idea of, well, not the idea, the people, they hated the experience of all of these independent farmers being brought together into state-controlled super farms, mm. because it meant they had to meet targets which were absolutely impossible. So the grain, the harvest was seized and taken to the center, and millions of people starved to death in the early 30s as a result.
Right.
So that's deeply associated with Stalin. So when they make jokes about the collective farms, some that turn up are, like, Stalin sleeps with a prostitute and he gets pubic lice, he gets crabs, right. and he can't get rid of them. The doctor can't help. He tries to get some advice. And in the end, he turns to one of his comrades and says, I just don't know what to do. He says, well, just declare that you're making it a collective farm and they will flee. Everyone would flee from trying to get in a collective farm.
I like that one. Just now, I could feel the, I guess, the relief that comes from that type of humor. Because, like, you read about the horrors of the starvations of the early 30s and Stalin's stubbornness when it came to that policy and, you know, knowing what was going on and, in fact, you know, pushing this policy forward in spite of these massive starvations. And you're just like, how would people ever cope with this? I'm going to make a terrible joke about you getting crabs. And all of a sudden, this, like, the horror of it is diffused, at least for a second.
And part of it is that if you tell these things as a joke and other people laugh around you,
yeah.
then you can mutually deceive yourselves in a really positive way for at least a moment there, that you share the burden effectively, because if I laugh at something and you laugh back, I'm like, oh, it's reassured. This can be funny. We can kind of allow this to play out. And that could be in the darkest possible tone, because the jokes that I found about collectivization, it would be hard to know that they were jokes if they weren't written in a joke format.
Right.
And reading them, be like, really? Is there anything here that's supposed to be funny? All you've basically said in a rhyme is that starvation comes as inescapably as frost in winter.
Right.
Why is that funny? But because they tell it in a funny way, we know that they're telling it because they want it to be expressed in a humorous fashion, and because they're not giving in to complete despair. Because if we do that, if we really resign ourselves, then jokes aren't what we turn to.
Right. Yeah, and then I noticed that, you know, on the other side of it, a lot of the jokes have Stalin or the other party leadership eating a lot. There's a lot of consumption. There's a lot of them sort of at these sort of absurd feasts. Is sort of another sort of common trope in the jokes, which I guess is sort of the other side of the starvation joke.
Yeah, they mock the leaders and say when Sergei Kirov is killed, who was the party boss of Leningrad and some thought a potential rival to Stalin. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of rumors that maybe Stalin had a hand in his murder, but that's never been proved. Mm-hmm. everyone had to observe a day of mourning. But a lot of that mourning seemed to involve people saying, look how fat Kirov is. He definitely doesn't get the same rations as us. Right. And then further jokes unfold, like, why are there cattle shortages? Oh, Stalin ate them. Oh, why are the leaders cremated when they die? Oh, they're going to be turned into soap, but Stalin's too fatty to do that.
Right.
And what they do, like, here's a little bit of the potential, like, cross-hatching of influences here, that they're taking a position that should feel like weakness to them because they're hungry, but they make themselves superior. And they do this through a couple of tropes. They play on both this quite religious imagery of being the ascetic monk-like figure who is purer because they don't indulge in the material world as much. They don't fetishize it. But the Bolsheviks as revolutionaries also claim to live and uphold an ascetic, restrained lifestyle.
Right. Yeah.
So they could be criticized from both directions at once.
You took on the question of the broader cult of personality, because in my own research, I sort of found what you found, which is a lot of people nod to the cult of personality, and they make a few remarks about statues going up and portraits going up everywhere, but they don't get into the nitty-gritty of how it was actually received, or I found it hard to find good studies on that, and yours was sort of the only one that resonated with me. And so as much as there are these vicious jokes about Stalin, there also did seem to be a level of love as well in there. How do you explain that?
Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I think a big part of it is that, well, I guess there's two big parts. One part is that the story that Stalin was representing, the myth he was trying to spin, could appeal to a lot of people. And this is something which, you know, in the Cold War was harder to talk about and to understand. But now looking at it as history, can look back and go, well, the promises of education for everyone in a country that was basically 90%, over 90% illiterate at that period, a country that was sorely underdeveloped, a country that had been humiliated by defeat to Japan in 1905, just a short while earlier. Stalin was saying, I'm going to take things up a level. We're going to make Russia and the Soviet Union at large a real world player and world power, or we're probably going to be attacked and defeated yet again. By the way, we're going to educate you. There's going to be endless opportunities for your personal advancement. And we've got rid of the people that you previously hated, who exploited you and kept you in a serf-like condition for the longest time.
Yeah.
We're bringing this egalitarian, glittering socialist future where the picture is you could be anything.
Right.
And that's a lot of possibility that people could buy into. And in the 1930s, people, many of them did.
Yeah.
They didn't experience it day to day. They were told it's just around the corner. And at least in this early period, you could keep believing it was coming around the corner.
Yeah.
And if you're in Moscow, incredible constructions are going up every day,
right, yeah,
where you really can become educated, where I think a really important thing was the opening of the Moscow metro, which if you ever go to Russia, it's worth going on the metro. It sounds a strange thing to say, but this has got, every station has got chandeliers.
Right.
There's marble, there's beautiful artworks and carvings. These were palaces for the people.
Right.
And even if you were living in poverty, you go to this incredibly futuristic, opulent mass transportation system, you could feel like, this is coming.
Mm-hmm.
This is for us. This is for the ordinary people. And look how amazing it is. I've only been aware of this as something that the nobility could have experienced.
Right.
So there's a taste for it. So there's an ability. Your question was about, like, how could people still try and buy into Stalin? Well, in part, some things are being delivered and the promise is very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And they could buy into the notion that he had a good idea. He was trying to push things in the right direction, but everything was being corrupted at the local level,
right,
by obfuscating bureaucrats.
Right.
And they could believe in the idea that there were saboteurs and wreckers everywhere.
Right.
And it's very easy to believe that when everything is going wrong, because the targets they're being told to meet are impossible.
Right.
There are a lot of angry people around, and blame is being shifted everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the political educators, like the ambassadors, the faces of the regime at the local level, down to your local factory or in your local farm, these people, many of them were petty and corrupt, but many of them were also trying their best with very limited education and very limited awareness of what they were supposed to do. So if it often just seemed like an absolute shambles, but not necessarily a malicious one.
Mm-hmm. I got that from it. And I know, I'm sure you've looked at this stuff, but anyone out there listening, a quick Google of, the Palace of Soviets, and you can kind of the ultimate sort of glittering dream of what that sort of epic socialist future would have been. And, just that the design of that building itself is just so intense. And but you can't help but be impressed by it, and also impressed by the ambition of such a thing. And that just seems like a metaphor for the entire project of the USSR, that it's this like wildly ambitious thing that probably can't ever be built.
Yeah. And how hard it must be. And maybe, we've experienced this in some ways in our lives. How hard must it be to confront the idea that maybe your leader is absolutely corrupt and you are being taken for a ride and abused? That's a very horrifying reality to try and countenance. I mean, I don't know what it's like for Americans right now. But it's so much more appealing to try and think, okay, well, maybe it's not as bad as it seems. Like, let's give this a chance. I would much rather believe that my leader has my best interests at heart than to believe they really could be doing such shockingly appalling things knowingly.
Right. Yeah. And that helps explain, I was watching there's a million Stalin documentaries out there, but I was watching one, I believe it was created by the BBC, back in the 90s. And, they interview a gulag survivor, and he's talking about how when Stalin died, he was in the gulag, and he went and found a private place and wept for Stalin, because in his mind, he's like, I'm in the gulag because of what you just spoke of, because of corrupt, local level politicians who just don't get it. And somewhere deep in the Kremlin, Stalin is working away with a single lamp, trying to like create the communist future. And in a way, that is sort of the ultimate success of his cult of personality, that even a person in the gulag could weep for him.
And there's something just immensely destabilizing about figures who seem to have been like a point around which everything else orbits. Mm-hmm. If they disappear, it's just very disturbing. It's as though a fixed point in time or a direction on your compass just disappeared. And that's going to provoke an emotional response in the immediate moment, even if many people, including that guy, would imagine later did some serious reassessment.
Right. Yeah. Well, speaking of figures who are compass points, I was also really fascinated about how Lenin appeared in the jokes. And I liked how you contrasted how Lenin appears in these jokes as opposed to Stalin. Would you mind explaining how Lenin turns up in the Soviet jokes?
Yeah, at least in this period, at least, Lenin is held up to a level of veneration. It's his cult that kind of was created as a platform to build Stalin's cult on, seemed to have been more successful in that people's responses were largely positive. So Lenin becomes a useful point of reference with which to criticize his successors. So there's various jokes of Lenin lying in the mausoleum, and Stalin will pop in and say, hi, how's it going, Vladimir Ilyich? And Lenin says, oh, it's okay, how are things with you? It's like, oh, well, the 5-year plan's progressing well. The people are with me. And Lenin says, well, if you pursue a second 5-year plan, the people will be with me.
Right.
I.e. dead.
Yeah. No, but I love that. I love the figure of like Lenin as Jacob Marley. You know what I mean? Just like ghost coming to haunt Stalin, being like, you've gone wrong, Stalin. It's Ilyich coming to tell you to change your ways. I find that image a lot of fun. But it got me thinking, and actually in my research for all of this, I think like many people that had perhaps a passing understanding of Soviet history, I was perhaps taken in by this myth a little bit that Lenin was a more admirable figure. He certainly doesn't have the blood on his hands that Stalin does, but someone who is sort of a little bit more, you know, worthy of perhaps respect. And then Stalin is the ultimate evil. And then the more I researched the topic, the more that perspective was complicated by reality. But to what extent do you sort of see that that cult of Lenin sort of perhaps even outliving the cult of Stalin?
Well, it continued through past the death of Stalin, and then when Khrushchev essentially denounces Stalin, they continue through the following years and the successive leaderships to say, we're getting back to Lenin, we're getting back to how things are meant to be. And it was easier for people to buy into this because, well, it's always easier to look back at the beginning and say, well, the first leader had it right. So now we need to get back to basics. And it's just been a case of going off piste and not following the plan through. But by the 1980s or so, even the role of Lenin in the jokes has changed again. And he's also seen increasingly in a negative light. Like, this is all your fault. When is this going to end?
Right. Another sort of aspect that I wanted to bring up before we kind of wrap up is one of my favorite things, I think, in life or in political discourse are those very sort of small moments of subversion. And you talk about how a lot of the jokes just reaffirm people's everyday life. So one example is that, you know, in the factories, people are sort of being fed this really perhaps overblown Soviet language that they're supposed to use, right? So we're supposed to be increasing class vigilance. And I love the just little detail that, like, in one particular factory, they're like, we shall increase class vigilance and we'll get a new shower head. Yes, we all agree a shower head is. I love that. That to me felt like a Monty Python sketch. How did the everyday creep into these jokes?
It's there a lot because it's used to undercut the soaring rhetoric, because people are, there's something just about the incongruity between the live reality and the soaring rhetoric that just kind of calls for a joke. And so if people are being called upon to go and attend the funeral of Kirov, then they can just kind of bat it away and go, well, I don't have fancy shoes for that, do I? No, I don't have that. Or people can, again, related to Kirov, they try and put like an everyday twist of how the death can possibly be a benefit to them. They say, well, you should go to lunch today at the canteen. Kirov's dead, so they're actually putting on some decent food today.
Right.
And it's little hints about, like, how could we make the best of this? How can we make this something that means something to us? But whilst they do all of this, and it can seem quite throwaway, and it is, we have to bear in mind that a lot of the material that I used is from criminal files, because people would be arrested for telling these jokes, and the typical sentence was to be put in a gulag for 10 years, or even to be for longer and accused of being part of a counter-revolutionary conspiracy, which in practice, from the materials in the file, meant you told a joke to some other people and they laughed. So clearly it's all a conspiracy.
Right. Before I let you go, I have to ask one thing. So, you know, we live in a time right now where politics all around the world have reached a new fever pitch. The response from a lot of people has been sort of a new brand of satire, or perhaps an old brand of satire, but there seems to be a lot of political comedy. And one of the questions people ask is, do the jokes matter? Back in the 1930s, did the jokes about Stalin matter?
That is a great question, and I think needs to be answered in a couple of different ways. they mattered enormously to the people who were telling them, which is a large part of why they would tell them, despite being increasingly aware of the risk that they were running in so doing. Because, so George Orwell once said, every joke is a tiny revolution. And I love it, but I think it's not enough. I think they're more than that. I think that joking is also a basic assertion of I exist. It's like I joke, therefore right. I am. That I'm not taken in by all of the contradictions and the false narrative that I'm being given. And even if I can't change anything and I have to go to work tomorrow, I'm still not just going to accept it like an unthinking automaton. I'm still going to assert myself, show that I see a different view, and I'm going to share it with the people that I trust enough to do so. And to have that ability not snuffed out allowed a lot of people to continue. And we can see this in even in Auschwitz, in Nazi concentration camps, people were telling jokes. There's books about that right. too, because it helped them keep a sort of fire of life, a spark of identity going. And it also mattered because this was a means by which people were able to find the others, the ones that they could trust to talk openly and share the hardships and their real experiences with each other. And I get into that more deeply at the end of the book. Because it was so dangerous to tell these jokes, jokes and like hinting towards a joke at first was a litmus test of trust. That if you could find people that you could tell jokes with, you knew you could be genuinely open with them. But you had to keep it very much on the down low. So there's a perspective of society under Stalin as though everyone was atomized, that you couldn't trust anybody. There's this sense that children could be denouncing parents, spouses might be denouncing each other, and that this genuinely happened. But even though it's often recorded in autobiographies and accounts of people who lived in this period, they say we were atomized, we were fearful, we couldn't trust anybody. And then they tell stories about how, of course, I could say anything to my old school right. friends. I could say anything to this person and that person. So they were... It's as though they perpetuated this idea we had of everyone being atomized because they themselves thought that society was atomized, but I obviously make person by person judgments, and humor was a massive yes. part of that. So the picture that I think we can paint from reconstructing the vastness of all this joke telling is that it wasn't an atomized society. It's a society where people were having to communicate in a very careful and selective way, and humor was part of the social lubricant as to how they could decide how to do it. It's signaling. I make the comparison with the Italian mafiosi. Yeah. The mafia people can't just say, "Hey, I'm in the mafia. Are you?" They have to give little signals, certain hints. Maybe it's a style of dress, but in the Soviet context, maybe it's more just leaving a significant pause yeah. or raising an eyebrow, and then you can gradually begin to open up and talk to each other.
Right. Finding your tribe because you happen to be standing at that angle where you can see the statue's penis.
That's absolutely it. Are you willing to see that? And when you do stand, like any joke, if you agree to the premise and you laugh at the punchline, it's like you both agree to stand and see things from that right. angle. Which is an incredible moment of intimacy, of seeing something that other people don't, and which you know maybe is a bit mm-hmm. taboo, and it binds you together in that moment. So in these ways and many more, the jokes really mattered as a way for people to connect, a way for people to make sense of and share the burden of their life and experiences and try and grapple the shredded parts of the rhetoric and try and bring it into something that made sense in every day. But did it matter politically? Well, the regime certainly thought it did. That's why people were being arrested for it. They did not like being laughed at. And they know that they made jokes about the former regime, which they pulled down and thought jokes surely therefore are a weapon that any regime has cause to fear. So they're very suspicious of it, and they begin to think of it even as a mind virus that could infect anyone. So they, when people are on trial for telling jokes, after the mid-1930s, the regime bans the quotation of the jokes during the court process because it would be very bad if anyone else heard them. So people are convicted and it's not even clear what for. So they're very fearful around the jokes. But should we, from a historical perspective, think, oh, okay, jokes are so toxic and dangerous to a regime like this. They really had to be feared. I don't think so. I don't think I've heard any convincing example of a political regime or system that was toppled by jokes. I think jokes may be part of a counter-revolution or an insurgency, but I don't think it's the jokes themselves which are the dangerous element. I think that the story of jokes in the Soviet Union, it has a lesson for us today, which is jokes can help us to accommodate and deal with practically anything. Right. And that's the good news. But the bad news is they can help us accommodate practically anything. So we can cope, we can deal with it, but should we? And are we fooling ourselves by making light of situations that really we shouldn't accept? Are we fooling ourselves into thinking, look, I'm pushing back, I'm a renegade, I'm definitely doing my bit by making a joke about Stalin? But really, I think what happens is you are accommodating yourself to a situation that you can't change. And I don't say that from a position of moral judgment. I think it's more a warning that we ought to bear in mind for ourselves, that we shouldn't confuse trying to help ourselves deal with something with an act of resistance or rebellion.
Right. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on Our Fake History today and infecting our listeners with your mind. I appreciate that. The book, for anyone that's interested, is called It's Only a Joke, Comrade. You can get it at online through Amazon. You can get it where all fine books are sold, I hope. John, thank you again for a really excellent conversation. I can't wait to see what you create next.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been, as I've been listening to the podcast quite a lot. So it's a real pleasure to be able to come on and talk to you directly. And I love the show and keep doing what you're doing.
That's super nice of you to say, man. But, I honestly, and I want everyone to hear this, I could not create this show unless real historians were out there doing real work. And John's one of the people out there doing the real work. So John, thanks again, man.
Thank you.
All right, cheers.
Okay, so there you have it, my conversation with John Waterlow. What a fascinating guy, right? Man, I really enjoyed listening back to that conversation just now. Again, I apologize for the terrible sound quality on my side of the conversation. I know my voice drops out at a few points. At the end there, I thanked John for infecting us all with his mind virus, which I thought was a hilarious callback to something we talked about earlier in the conversation. Anyway, thanks again to John Waterlow for being such a thoughtful and gracious guest. If you want to hear more from John and hear more of that great voice, didn't he have such a good podcast voice? Well, if you want to hear more of that, then you should check out his podcast. His show is called Voices in the Dark. You can find it where you get all of your podcasts, or if you want to look at their website, you can go to voicesinthedark.world and check it out there. Also, if you want to find out more about his book, you can go to the official website for his book, which is onlyajokecomrade.com. And I'll remind you that we are giving away a free copy of It's Only a Joke, Comrade. All you got to do is send in your best Stalin joke to ourfakehistory@gmail.com. If you are not sick of hearing me talk about Stalin, then you should really listen to the Eastern Border podcast, where just last week I was a guest. Yes, me and the host Krzysztofs talked about Stalin and all sorts of other weirdness for about an hour on his podcast. It was a great conversation. Krzysztofs was a really wonderful host, and we had a really fun time talking to each other. So if you enjoy hearing me talk a little more off the cuff, a little less scripted than Our Fake History normally is, then go over to the Eastern Border podcast. Check out, I believe it's their most recent podcast, but if you're listening to this in the future, then scroll back through and look for my name and listen to what me and Krzysztofs had to say about Stalin. Before we go this week, as always, I need to give a few shout-outs. Today, I would like to give a shout-out to Alexander Udalov, Braca, Sachin Sharma, Catherine Fritcher, Henry Hall, Kelly Taylor, Seb Bakanu, and shout out to Seb for being another Sebastian out there. Love you, buddy. Sazba Suto, hope I pronounced that right. Mary Luongo, Joran Busman, and Woody Woodburn. All of you folks have decided to pledge at the $5 or more level, so you know what that means. That makes you beautiful human beings. Thank you so much for supporting the show. As I've said many times before, right now is a really good time to join Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory, you can sign up and you will then be getting the upcoming extra episode, which should be out around the holidays. That's the holidays of 2018-2019. The new extra episode is going to be about the Knights Templar. So if you want to get your hands on that and all the other extras, which are now many in number, there's a lot of them there now, you should sign up for Patreon. And it's also a great way to support the show. It's what keeps us going. It's the number one way I am turning podcasting into a job. So thanks again to everyone that's pledging at all levels. You are the best people. You're the best people. I love you. Okay, if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory, or you can go to the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/ourfakehistory and follow along with all the stuff I am posting there. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major. And remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real. ¶¶